So I think I might actually be a bit less critical of crisis than the other panelists, but that might actually be useful. As Randy suggested in his opening remarks, which were also sort of derived from the provocation that he sent us for this panel, crisis has perhaps proved less well-suited for the meditative practices of critical thought than the shared etymology of crisis and critique that he alludes to would suggest. Nor, of course, has it entirely provided the political opportunity we once might have wishfully imagined. Far from functioning as an apocalyptic rending of the ideological veil, which is, I think, what most of us, most theories of crisis suppose that it would do, that would reveal the nature of capitalism, this crisis has arguably done nothing so much as reaffirm the insights of Jameson and Zizek on the post-ideological nature of the current epoch, in which the utility of both crisis and critique is undermined by the fact that we all already knew what was happening, but simply chose to continue going on as if we didn't. And in the few minutes I have to speak on these questions today, then, I want to do little more than lay out in some further detail these questions and speculate somewhat on their consequences. It seems to me that the provocation Randy has offered us to think about the uses and disadvantages of crisis for thought has to do with a kind of contradiction between historiography, the history we tell, and politics, the history we live. By turning in conclusion to one particular site, the recent student movement against increased tuition, privatization, and student debt, I want to argue that in both its theory and its praxis, recent student militancy suggests solutions to the problems of crisis in the overlapping and overdetermined domains of politics, culture, and thought. For all of the theoretical problems that emerge when thinking crisis, the dominance of crisis in the last few decades or so of critical thought was initially, I think, a solution to other problems, conceptual problems, that is. In the age of the so-called post-historical, crisis gave us a way to think history as both continuity and change, both repetition and difference. Put otherwise, in one way or another, we are all Aregians now. The sense of historical change is occurring in a manner both cyclical and intensifying, of crisis not only in time but also in space, gave us a way out from those much maligned grand narratives with their supposedly totalizing, homogenizing nature. So in other words, I think one of the ways that I am reading crisis is not so much as being threatened by the critique of grand narratives as a kind of response to it and a kind of attempt to work around it. The understanding of crisis as a structure that repeats in given moments further squares the gap between structuralist synchrony, the inherent, implacable, and necessary contradictions of that old MCM prime, and a more post-structuralist, overdetermined account of historical uncertainty, as neither iron law nor pure chance, but rather as tendency. Crisis will necessarily occur, but when and in what matter seemed open to some contingency. And yet, if predicting crisis got us out of some thorny theoretical impasses, living in crisis has, not surprisingly, tempered the strength of our enthusiasm. For one thing, the question emerges whether using crisis as our intellectual lodestar isn't thinking in capitalism as much as thinking against capitalism. Is not crisis the melting of all that is solid into air, capitalism's own logic? And is not the central, brilliantly counterintuitive point of Marx's theory that crises typically enable the transition to some even more extensive and intensive form of capital? Adding insult to injury, moreover, the particular perversity of the contemporary financial economy is precisely its own singular capacity to take full advantage of risk, threat, and the kinds of lightning speed changes that may have been more fully accounted for by the arbitragers than by the philosophers. And anyway, how are we to know when the final terminal crisis has arrived? Do we not risk facing the same predicament as contemporary theorists of the event whose very nature is to be unrepresentable and unforeseeable until after it has already passed, by which point it may, of course, be too late? While on the one hand, then, a sense of crisis as the tendency of capitalism gives us a compelling structure for historical narrative, an effective conceptual apparatus for the history we encounter at a slight distance, it perhaps leaves us at an impasse as regards politics, the history of which we are immediately, urgently, both subjects and objects. If the figure of crisis emerged as a way to think outside the end of history with its frozen, changeless present, and if it has also served as the basis for some belief in the inevitability of an end of capital, even when all we see is the failure and exhaustion of attempts to do just that. It has served less well as a way to think subjective antagonism and historical agency. To use terms familiar to narrative theory, crisis restored history to us by removing history's characters, by eschewing the fantasy of autonomous, knowing, exceptional historical agents, but it has left us with a sense of history merely as plot, as implacable necessity unavailable to human intervention. Or perhaps it has. What I want to suggest against this pessimism, however, and this is just to sort of turn to a particular site of theory and praxis that I know the best. I don't even think that it's particularly singular or exceptional. Is that in both its theory and in both their theory and their praxis, recent student militancy against privatization, layoffs, cutbacks, and especially against student debt have both used the discourse of crisis and given us a way to think beyond its limitations and within its contradictions. In emphasizing the centrality of student debt to an anti-privatization movement, student militants have clarified the link between financialization, those forms of credit securitization central to the speculative economy of the last three decades, and the forces of neoliberalism. The fact of student debt renders visible and present the public money that is no longer available to pay for education, providing a kind of chalk outline of the state support gone missing, of the absence of the social surpluses that once funded public goods like higher education. Financialized credit evacuates the political and reduces the collective to isolated parts, to credit scores, risk assessments, interest rates. While inscribing debt as shame and guilt, it simultaneously imagines credit as an equal and circular exchange. In the student movement, by contrast, mutual indebtedness has been the basis for radical collective affiliation, and thus debt appears in its collective form as an aggregation of soon-to-be unpayable loans. And here I should just say, because Stefano Harvey isn't here, that his piece with Fred Moten on student debt has been really central to my thinking about this. Like Marx's proletariat, who are both a requirement of and a threat to developed capitalism, the we of mutual indebtedness is a collective subject self-constituted over and over again under the sign of crisis and precarity, a we of the radically subprime. By seeing themselves as debtors, by seeing themselves as the embodied collateral of the collateralized debt obligation, students forge themselves as a political class with shared interests. The centrality of debt to these movements appears at the level of praxis as well as theory. In particular, the tactics of occupation, barricade, and other modes of transforming space, particularly the space of the university, insists on the political and economic importance of spaces outside the traditional regimes of production. And in fact, I think, sort of turns us back to the regime of reproduction. If, as Gilles Deleuze famously suggested, we have moved from control by enclosure to control by debt, the repossession and redefinition of space made possible by building occupations represents the form of protest most appropriate to this historical conjuncture, as the tactic of protest shifts from the counter-enclosure of the picket line to the fluidity and mobility of an indebted we. Student militants have also pushed back against a kind of restorative logic under which different sectors of the public sphere compete with one another for scarce resources. Against the liberal rhetoric of negotiation and a social contract based, like credit, on mutual obligation, student militants retorted, "Occupy everything, demand nothing." To demand nothing is to reassert the antagonism between exploiter and exploited, an antagonism that cannot be resolved by contractual negotiations precisely because it has never been a basis for social mutuality. Students also refuse the language of responsibility and doing time, seeing in this discourse the ideology of the creditor, the association of sin and guilt with debt and of redemption with payback, whether voluntary or punitive. In refusing to readily face the consequences, they demanded the very exceptional status, accepted from punishment, accepted from repayment, that has heretofore been the sole privilege of the creditor class. What then does this have to do with crisis? I want to suggest that if, as I have claimed, the power of crisis at the conceptual level is in its capacity to draw on both the universal and the particular, both the synchronic and the diachronic, the student movement has seized on this dialectic between the necessity of the totality and the contingent specificity of its instances. The crisis in the university is the site, not the horizon, of this movement. Structurally, the student loan market is poised for a crash with or without political intervention, of course. Even during the better employment market of the late 90s and early 2000s, the estimated default rate of borrowers attending for-profit institutions, and this is, of course, where the growth is largely, was close to 40%. And current estimates anticipate that the default rate on all private loans will soon be 50%. In this and other regards, the coming student loan crisis mirrors and is prefigured by the collapse of the housing market. This uncanny historical echo is more than merely a structural similarity, moreover. As Joshua Clover, I'm quoting here from a previous presentation he gave, but he made a similar argument yesterday, has recently and powerfully explained, the sites of U.S. student militancy of the last few years maps with eerie precision onto the sites most devastated by eviction and foreclosure. Higher education militancy, he observes, proceeds in absolute solidarity with mortgage failure, bankruptcy, and foreclosure, even if it does not know this. The observation of a solidarity that exceeds the consciousness of knowing subjects, that is the manifestation of a crisis that extends beyond sectors and subjects, but is in the nature of the total system, gives us a view on crisis as at once necessary and contingent, fact and possibility. Declaring we are the crisis, the student movement operates at the intersection of radical agency and the tendential catastrophe of the system, between the freedom of characters and the slow lumbering of historical plot. A work of graffiti documented on the UC Berkeley campus during the protests of 2009 made clear the relationship of this militant theory and praxis to the problematic of crisis. To a banal marketing encomium reading, "Thanks to Berkeley," was added, "I'm in debt forever." Read in the context of a collective movement, the melancholic awareness that "I'm in debt forever" becomes a positive threat. I'm in debt forever. After all, the logic of credit is to defer payment into the future, but not to defer it forever. Much as to demand nothing is also to demand everything, to be in debt forever is to refuse to be in debt at all. The tagging student's cri de coeur thus evokes both the objective likelihood of a structural crisis in the credit markets and the subjective possibility of revolutionary forms of mutual and mass default. It robs credit of its calculability, its claim on the future earnings of the individual worker and of social production as such. It refuses to balance the books, to pay its debt to society. Instead, "I'm in debt forever" proposes the interdependence and vertical mutuality that goes by the name not of debt, but of solidarity. It rejects the association of debt with guilt, restoring the antagonism between borrower and lender. Scrawled anonymously on the university's property, it is not so much solitary confession as collectively authored sabotage. It is a negation of the empty promises of a circular exchange, of the return of a loan to the creditor, and it warns of a crisis that cannot itself be deferred for long.